I prefer it to spend the time in conversation rather than me talking all the time. So if anyone has anything they would like to discuss or any questions they'd like to ask, please feel free to do so. There is a tray for questions down below, which you may have seen. But there will be another question and answer session this afternoon that will be in Thai. This morning is more kind of informal. So if anyone would just like to ask, but if you're very shy and you'd like to write something down, you can do that as well. I'm assuming everyone can understand English, okay? I speak English with an Ubon accent. I'd just like to start off with relating one or two incidents, things that happened to me or things that I remember from time before I became a monk, which really, really impressed me, and it led me to search for some answers to things, answers to questions. One of them was the experiment, which many of you may have heard of, have heard about, or a number of experiments that were conducted in Columbia University in the early 60s by Professor Milgram. Has anybody heard about this before? And for the early 60s, people were still very concerned with the question about how did it happen that Germany, which was in many respects the most advanced civilization in Western Europe, by advanced scientifically, technologically, artistically, philosophically. You could say that Germany was really the leader in so many fields, the flower of Western civilization, and yet it resulted in the horrors of Nazi Germany. So at that time people were very interested in trying to find some explanation for how this happened. And the experiment, very famous experiments, Professor Milgram, took place in New York, in which he invited people to participate in a learning experiment. The people who volunteered for the experiment were shown into a room, and behind a glass compartment was an overweight man sitting and in a chair with all kinds of electrical wires attached to him. And in the main room there were a number of scientists all wearing white with clipboards, and there were a number of levers going from 10 volts up to something like 300 volts. And the volunteers were told that this was an experiment to determine the effect of punishment on learning speed. If someone was asked a question and he couldn't answer, the guinea pig, the man sitting in the chair, was asked a question. If he couldn't answer it within a number of seconds, he should be given an electric shock, say 10 volts. And then if he couldn't get the next question right, then it would have to be increased to 20 volts. And they wanted to see whether this would help his memory, jog his memory, the fear of the pain. And the volunteers were also told that the man in the chair had a heart condition, so they should be careful. And it turned out that the man in the chair was not very good at answering the questions, and he needed electric shocks to help him. And the electric shocks didn't do much good either. Now, as he was given electric shocks, after a certain number of volts, he started to scream. And he was obviously in a great deal of pain. And the volunteers also knew that he had a heart condition, so it was dangerous to him. Now, the crux of this experiment, of course, was that the man in the chair was an actor, and he wasn't really receiving electric shocks at all. And the experiment wasn't about learning speeds. The experiment was to see whether ordinary people off the street would be willing to give large amounts of electric shocks to somebody if they were in a position where they didn't have to take any responsibility. And the very shocking results were that 70 or 80% of the people were willing to go all the way up to 200 volts, 250 volts. Very, very few people refused. And people were often very tense and anxious about it, but they were asked, is this all right? Are you taking responsibility? Am I going to get into trouble for this? And when they knew that they were absolutely free of responsibility, they were willing to do these most horrific things, give somebody who they thought had a heart condition, extremely high levels of electric shock, to the extent the person was screaming and squirming, was being tortured, in other words. These experiments were repeated in various ways with various modifications a number of years. I'm sure if you were to look up on the internet, you could find accounts of them. But this shocked America, who in those days people tended to think that the Nazis were monsters, of some kind of special evil force that had arisen in Germany. And these experiments seemed to show that under certain conditions, just ordinary people in any country can do the most horrible things. And I remember first reading about these experiments and being really shocked and fascinated, but interested also in seeing whether there was some kind of morality, some kind of principle by which people lived and which would prevent them from being so easily manipulated and so easily overwhelmed. So this was one turning point in my own intellectual search and studies. Another experiment concerned hypnosis. I was very interested in hypnosis. And there's an very well-known professor in America, in Los Angeles, I think, called Professor Charles Tart. And he's done many, many experiments on hypnosis. This particular one that I remember concerned the ajahn, or the teacher, and the volunteer who is hypnotized. And the volunteer is told, when you come out of the hypnotic state, when you hear the key word, let's say, would you like a cup of coffee? Then I want you to go over to the door and put up the umbrella. Okay. So he comes out of the hypnotic state. They're sitting, chatting. And then the teacher says, would you like a cup of coffee? The man immediately gets up, walks over to the door, and puts up the umbrella. And the teacher says, why did you do that? And he immediately, without stopping to think, says, well, it was a bit cloudy on my way over today and I didn't bring an umbrella myself, and I just wanted to see whether that umbrella was usable and I might think to borrow it. Now, that, if you think about it, that's quite stunning, in that he performed an action which was completely irrational, with no reason at all, simply because he was asked to do it in a hypnotic state. But the moment that he did it, and without having any time to prepare an answer or to lie, he was able to produce a very reasonable explanation for why he was doing a completely irrational thing. And needless to say, this doesn't just happen under those very special circumstances. He was asked, why is it, and I've wondered this myself, why is it that people seem to be, majority of people seem to be so easily hypnotized? You know, you just watch, tick, tick, you know, how is it this? And he said, most people's normal consciousness is only that much far away from hypnotic state. And so all it means is just just the slightest depression, you just tip someone over the edge into hypnosis. Because most people live in a semi-hypnotic state. And we're all very intelligent at finding very rational reasons for acting in irrational ways. So this was another experiment which really interested me a lot and set me to look for ways of training the mind in order to transcend this extremely superficial, mechanical, semi-hypnotic, robotic kind of state which most people live their lives in. And this was led me to the Buddhist teachings. The third thing I'd like to share with you is a cartoon which I like very much. And it was a cartoon set in the bacon factory. And there's this little big warehouse, and there's these doors, and that's where the pigs go in and get made into bacon. And all the pigs are standing in a very orderly queue. Some are reading newspapers, chatting, laughing, and just waiting for their time to be made into bacon. And then there's two little piglets climbing up the wall, and they're escaping through the skylight. And one of the middle-aged pigs, he looks up to the other one and he says, that's the problem with the younger generation these days. All they think about is running away from reality. And, of course, this, you know, the point being, what do you want to do? Just sit around and wait till you're made into bacon. So I was interested in finding a better way of living my life than queuing up to be made into bacon. This is what also led me to leave England and to that time I was 17 and I worked in a building site and in a warehouse and made some money and then hitchhiked to India to have some adventures and find out something about Buddhism. So, has anybody thought up anything they'd like to discuss? Anything you'd like to ask about? Yes.
I have read also that they say that in every one of us we have Buddha in our heart, but it's covered with gilet, tanha, and all that. But also in several cases we see people get away with doing wrong things, and we think, why can't we do that? Why can't, maybe we can do that, do bad thing, and then we can get away from that also. Which one is true? I mean, between people are good inside, I mean in natures, deep down inside they are good, or deep down inside they are bad, I guess.
Yeah. Well, the Buddha generally avoided metaphysics and metaphysical explanations and concepts to say human beings are really like this, human beings are really like that. But the Buddha said, look at yourself right now, what do you see? Rather than taking something as a concept or as a teaching from an enlightened being, you look at your own self, and I think that what you see is that there's a mixture. There are noble impulses in everyone, and there are ignoble impulses in everyone. And the noble and the ignoble impulses are not fixed or inherent in the human mind. And this is why the Buddhist training has been given to us, because we have the capacity to examine the root causes of the ignoble, or you call the bad, or the evil impulses, and we can undermine them and completely eliminate them. And we can also recognize the roots and the causes and conditions for the arising and the growth of the noble and the good qualities, and we can develop them. And this is, in fact, the heart of spiritual life, is the effort to abandon what we call the unwholesome and develop the wholesome. If you have an idea of human beings as being intrinsically evil or having original sin, then Buddhist training doesn't make much sense, because the more you worked on yourself, then the more you uncover this original sin. And the teaching of Buddha nature is more, in the Theravada tradition, it's a potential. But unless we do the work, then we never realize that potential. So the Buddha is saying that there's absolutely nothing that is fixed. The Buddhist teachings are a great interest to many scientists, particularly physicists, these days or the past 20, 30 years, because Buddhism is a teaching in which everything is seen in terms of processes rather than as things. If you think of you have this thing called a heart, a soul, a personality, and there's me in here, then you never really understand Buddhist teachings, never can really derive much benefit from them. That's when you're willing to question that basic assumption you make about yourself and look very directly and see what is going on here right now, free of theories and concepts, what's my experience right now? And then Buddhist teachings start to become a lot more clear. I think, if many of you are now living in other countries, and it is an opportunity to make a lot of merit through being an ambassador for Buddhism And that's not to say, of course, being an evangelical and going around and trying to convert people, because that's considered un-Buddhist to do that, if you like. In fact, monks are forbidden from doing that by their discipline. But at the same time, it's probably happened to you on a number of occasions that people have asked you, oh, you're a Buddhist, you know, what's Buddhism all about, or what do you believe in? And I would guess that many of you have had a lot of difficulties answering that question. So, you know, trying to discover some clear vision and understanding of what Buddhism is and what Buddhism teaches, at least so as not to misrepresent Buddhist teachings and in a way to be a representative of them, I think is a very wholesome aspiration. The distinction I make generally is that religions can be divided into two families. And there is the family of religions that grew up in the Middle East with Judaism, Christianity, Islam as the three major religions of that family. And they are all systems of belief. Those religions are often referred to as faiths. We call them the Christian faith or the Muslim faith, the Jewish faith, which shows very clearly that faith, belief, is considered to be the most important virtue. You define yourself, you identify yourself as a member of those religions through your belief system. But Buddhism is not a belief system. And so when people say, oh, you're a Buddhist, what do you believe in? If you answer them in those terms, then you're already, you've lost your ground, your solid ground. You're not going to be able to explain properly, because Buddhism is not about believing things. And teachings in Buddhism are not dogmas to be believed in, but they are tools that are used in this education process. So it's not a system of beliefs, but it's a system of education. And the idea in Buddhism is that spiritual life consists of a education of the way you live in the world, the way you relate to the physical world, the way you relate to the people around you. It's an education of the inner world of thoughts, emotions, and most importantly, the education of your wisdom faculty. So the teachings play a very different role in Buddhism than they do in the religions that you find in the West. And this, you know, when people say all religions teach the same thing and so on, that's kind of tactful and kind of good way to prevent too much hatred and prejudice between religions, but I don't think it's particularly true. There are major differences, particularly between the belief system religions and the education system of Buddhism. Anybody, anything else? Yes.
That's a crap. In a course like this, the regimen that we are practicing is somewhat suitable for many of the people here who are on holiday and for some who are having a long weekend. Now, soon enough, we're going to go back to the actual routine of life. How do we modify the regimen that we are doing here in the actual reality?
Yes, I was going to speak a bit more about that probably today or tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. But briefly, the practice of Dhamma, Buddhist practice, is not a matter of going on retreats and doing a lot of sitting and walking meditation alone. That's a very important part of it, and it will take your mind to a more refined and clearer space than it would normally be. But ideally, it's a whole way of looking at life and a whole way of living in the world, as they say, how you relate to your possessions, how you relate to the environment, how you behave towards your family members, how you deal with negative emotions that arise in your mind, learning to find ways of leading your life with more and more wisdom and less craving. It's a willingness to look at life, look at experience, and learn from experience. That this is the heart of the Buddhist way. And I find myself continually surprised at the huge disparity that I see in the intelligence people apply to their studies and to their business life, and the intelligence they apply to their own minds and their own happiness and suffering. You know, if you're undergoing periods of suffering in your life, this is not because of the stars. You know, it's not because of a God punishing you for something. It's a matter of causes and conditions, and it's a matter of the way you're looking at life, the matter, the way that you think about things, the way that you conduct yourself. And you can apply your intelligence and in order to create positive changes in your life in a way that very few people seem willing to commit themselves to. Mostly people have to reach a real crisis in their life before they wake up. This has been inverted in Thailand often. And what I mean by that is that if people go to monasteries or people start practicing, people say, oh, he's obviously got a problem. You know, it's like it's a last refuge for people who are having a hard time. But in actual fact, the number of people who are having a hard time that turn to other more destructive ways of dealing with their suffering far outweigh the people who go towards the Dhamma. And people who encounter suffering in their life and turn towards Dhamma are the intelligent ones. So it's something to be praised rather than anything else. But the Buddhism is essentially about your life, your experience in life, your experience of suffering, your experience of pleasure and happiness. And the teachings are all concerned with this, you know, and what to do about it. You know, you may be doing quite well at the moment. You mostly come from wealthy families. You've never had to worry about where the next meal is going to come from. You've all been provided with education and grown up without any great deal of struggle in your life, I would say. But there's no reason why you have a right to experience this same kind of smooth life that you are now. I mean, the chances are that you will, but the chances that something may arise in your life and upset you deeply are always there. I would suggest you make a list of your parents' generation, their friends, the people of their age group, about 20 of them, and you see just how many of them have been through major life crisis, even quite wealthy people, whether it's serious illness, bereavement, divorce, their company going bankrupt, so many possible things. And if your mind is just like a good weather mind, you know, you can be happy when everything's going well, you've got money to spend, and life's going well, and you, then you're in a very precarious position. It says this is being heedless. The Buddha's giving you tools basically to discover a kind of happiness and security which is independent of the external world. It's something that all of us are capable of discovering if we're interested enough and willing to make a commitment to this kind of study. In fact, the search for wealth and for fame and power and all these things, does it really provide, you know, what we think it does? There have been many studies of this very question. There's an ajahn called Professor Kasa in Rochester, New York, who's done a lot of work on this. And we find that compared with a group of, say, not so materialistic people whose major life goals are materialistic or to make money or even more money, have appreciably higher levels of mental illness in almost every possible category. They've been asking people for about 50 years now, are you happy? Are you very happy? And the proportion of people in the States who say they're very happy, it's been stable at about 30-something%. So 70% say they're not happy. That's over and apart from the people who aren't happy but say they are. But anyway, 30%. Whereas at the same time, the economy of America and general wealth has increased by about 200%. And studies show over and over again, in fact they confirm teaching of the Buddha, that what we really need are, we call, the four requisites. That is to say, you need to have a steady supply of food, nutritious food, you need clothes, you need a roof over your head, and you need medicines when you're sick. If you lack any of those, there's no way you're going to be happy or peaceful in your life. You're going to be in a really bad way. But once you've got those four things, then an increase in them will have almost no effect on your actual sense of happiness. Let's say right now, enjoy the beauty of the countryside, the cool weather, talking with your friends, so on. Just very basic, ordinary things. Let's say you get a telephone call and say someone's given you 100 million baht. Okay, you get really excited, now you're rich. But how much will that increase your appreciation of the countryside, of the breeze, of your friend's conversation, of the kindness of others. I wouldn't say at all. So, you know, where is actually the profit? There's so much of this search for more and more is coming from the position of insecurity and naivety, a lack of interest in looking at experience rather than believing other people. Remember when years ago, I'm not sure whether they do this anymore, and you have to forgive me if this is a bit crude, but young English schoolboys used to have a game, and what they do is they'd all stand in a line, and they'd see who could urinate the highest. And then if you could urinate higher up in the air, you were the winner. And I've always thought, you know, seeing the way people live in society, you know, they're just playing the same game, you know, to the age, you know, who's got the biggest house, the best car, you know, it's basically the same game of who can urinate the highest. You know, it's just, so, from my point of view, you know, just if your whole life is bound up with making more and more money, it's just a very kind of sad and pathetic way to waste a human life. There's so much more that can be experienced in life that you shut yourself off from if your goals are too narrowly materialistic.